Welcome to the AEW Investors Call. As a reminder, all lines are muted. If you would like to ask a question, please click star 69 on your telephone. I will now turn the call over to Josh Nason of Wrestling Observer and Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics. Please go ahead, Josh.
Well, after a few months away, I finally returned from my slumber, podcast slumber, and I'm back with a great guest to kick things off, get me back out of it, Brandon Thurston, WrestleNomics, the Pollock and Thurston Show, a newsbreaker, a heartbreaker, hopefully not a window breaker, but he is back, and we're doing our Q4 analysis, our investors call, so to speak, for AEW. Yes, it's mid-March, and we're doing this, but we have some numbers and some insight as we're almost done with Q1 of 2024. So as we've done for, I think this might be number four. I think we've done this pretty much all year, right? If I remember.
Is this the 1 year mark?
I think it might be. So we'll have to do KPIs in this podcast as well, I guess. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I've been, I'm listening to the Muzak jazz music. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to go. Ready to report on the fourth quarter earnings for All Elite Wrestling LLC, which is, it is an LLC, by the way, for, I know everybody's wondering, limited liability company, and we're ready to go.
Excellent stuff. Yes, my wife has given the intro as well. The Muzak is finished and ready to go. So if this is your first time here, we kind of go over all the big highlights, the numbers that we do know, some analysis at WrestleNomics. You can subscribe to for a very low fee every month on Patreon. Just search for WrestleNomics if you're not already. There's an exclusive PDF with some of these numbers in there, which you can check out. And if you're not already checking out WrestleNomics, great podcast every week from Brandon. And obviously does his Pollock and Thurston appearance as well. And I think that's my positive plug for the WrestleNomics service.
Thank you. You're much better at it than me. Sign up if you want.
That should be your logo, your slogan. Sign up if you want. That's it. We'll take that. So let's do it. So we're going to talk October, November, December, and in going through, you know, compiling some of the stuff is interesting. Looking back and kind of, you know, seeing where we are now in mid-March, as we're, of course, on Friday, we just had a big business, you know, very fitting name, considering this podcast today. And I was there in Boston.
Garden. I was kind of wondering, but I thought you were in Maine or something. Did you make the trip?
Yes. Well, Maine is not that far away from Boston. I will tell you that much, depending on where you are, of course. But yeah, I'm in I'm in New Hampshire. So
New
I'm
Hampshire. About That's right.
An hour and a half outside. And took the train in. I will guarantee we're the Wrestling Observer was the most well-represented media outlet at the TD Garden that night. We had myself, Joe Currier, our lead editor, who is also from nearby Massachusetts.
Okay.
Ethan Renner, who is a major Mercedes Moné fan dating back years and years and years, flew up from Baltimore to see this in person. We had never actually met in person before, so it was good to get a chance to meet him. JJ Williams, who is does a lot of great images and pictures and is affiliated with us, he flew in as well. There's a gentleman named Sam that is a big fan of the website. He was there. So yeah, there was a whole bunch of us there on site. So yeah, very well represented media outlet.
Yes. What is the WrestleTixon? I think Dave had reported 9,400 distributed for that, which will be the most attended. It was the most attended Dynamite in months since Grand Slam.
Yeah. I would say that's pretty accurate. That whole lower bowl was full. I've been
Did you in count the heads. Count them individually.
I didn't. I paid some kids to do it outside, but then they disappeared. Okay. So yeah, okay. Unfortunately, yeah.
Just don't cross state lines when you do that, though.
Okay. it was that lower bowl was really full, and the upper bowl was kind of hard to see from where we're sitting in the lower bowl because of the scoreboard and the lighting rig and all that stuff. But it was. I mean, it was loud in there all night, and it was they were into it all night, and yeah, it was it was kind of interesting seeing the viewership number come out, and obviously so many people just claiming, oh, this is such a disaster, all that stuff. You were there in that building, or you watched on TV. It was not a disaster by any means. It was a great moment for the company. I think it was a great moment for her. She seemed to be kind of just Just it seemed to mean a lot to her. You had Okada there, you had Ospreay. It just felt like, and this is probably my seventh or so AEW show, both in Boston and then also in Newark for Full Gear and seeing a Rampage there and so on. This it felt like, you know, Ospreay said the whole thing, getting the feeling back or whatever it is. I don't know if they're all the way back, and the number is, but the number was, but it felt like there was a very good energy among the fans. It felt fresh. You know, the only thing it kind of felt off was the Jericho hook match, but people were into everything else. They stayed for Rampage. So yeah, it was a great night. It was a great night overall. And it was kind of disappointing just to see some of the dialogue about the number being such a big disappointment, because I thought it was from a fan perspective, being there just felt like an overall great night.
You know, the attendance was really strong. As you said, it's the highest since Grand Slam. The rating was a totally normal rating. So it was not an elevated rating for people tuning in for the debut of Mercedes Moné. And in fact, we have just gotten, I don't know if you've gotten the alert on your, as a subscriber of the WrestleNox Patreon, we now have the overrun, which we did not have last night. The overrun changes nothing, really. It's instead of 801,000 viewers on average, it's 798,000, if I can say words here, and numbers. Very slightly lower. The demo is unchanged, literally unchanged. In the thousands of years, it's exactly the same. So, I'm looking at the YouTube views for the clip of Mercedes Moné's debut, and it's currently, as we speak here today, on, am I allowed to say when we're recording this?
Of course.
Friday afternoon. So of course the debut happened on Wednesday night. We're now at 675,000 views, which if I compare that to, like, obviously that's nobody's going to be what Punk was. If I compare that to like the Edge debut, which I think did hit multiple millions over the course of 7 days. So it's probably somewhere below the Edge debut. Obviously it's still a big deal. Was it merch, by the way? I heard there was a lot of merch.
They did an exclusive shirt that I don't know, because I didn't really do a big walk of the concourse, but they announced it in the building. There was special, you know, event specific merch, and Ethan tried to go up and buy some, but all there was left, this was like an hour and a half into the show, maybe an hour, 15 minutes. It was basically just smalls and mediums left. It was like a green event specific shirt. So they did pretty well, I think, with that.
Not many smalls and mediums getting bought up among the wrestling crowd. Huh?
Definitely not. No. But yeah, that was the only kind of merch. But yeah, I mean, people were into it, and we'll kind of see where it goes. But there was a, you know, I think it is good to be like, it was just a great night. It was a great feeling in there. And yeah, especially for the Okada, you know, the Okada match, the Trios match there, and I mentioned, and even Will Ospreay coming out, WWE or AEW is really big into songs that people can chant to and sing to, which is a trend that WWE is really kind of latched onto. And the whole CEO thing, the Ospreay, he's, you know, really kind of pointing the crowd to sing at certain times, and people are really kind of into it. And yeah, I mean, they got some good houses coming up, with Toronto and Edmonton coming up, I believe, is another one, looked pretty decent. So yeah, I mean, there's, we'll see. I guess we'll kind of see what happens. We'll talk about that as we do the next one of these. But I thought it was a good night, and hopefully it starts, you know, some good stuff for them and go from there.
So Toronto, I have my own spreadsheet for WrestleTix data, mm-hmm. and I've added to it a column that tries to predict, based on the number of days that are left before the event, where this estimated tickets distributed is going to end up. So for like Toronto, which is currently at just under 5,000 out, estimated, will end up, if my formula is right, at about 6,000, which will be better than a number of Dynamites in recent history.
Exactly. And we're going to talk about that now. So let's start with the October through December. We'll see what led us to this point. So some of the big highlights of the month, they had three pay-per-views in the quarter for the first time ever, with both Wrestle Dream, Full Gear, and World's End. And Wrestle Dream was in Seattle, did 71.08 for a gate of 533.17. Pay-per-view buys were, looks like about the max was about 125,000. I think you had, call it 113,000.
I took the median, I think, of what you put in the notes.
Okay, got it. Yeah, and yeah, I didn't really have an official final number on that. We also had full gear in Los Angeles in November. And that did just under 13,000 fans. I couldn't find a gate number anywhere.
I don't think that there is one. When I did my annual estimate of revenue, I put in, you know, a number that I thought was reasonable based on the other pay-per-views, but you know, it did have what was the estimated tickets distributed. I think you have it on here, right? 12,900.
Yep.
So I don't know if that's $1 million gate, but that's close to $1 million gate.
And then buys were right in the range of a couple median of 131,000. And then we had World's End on Long Island. Closed out the year December, of course, the first one there. Just over 10,000 fans for that, 10,093. Did not have a gate for that I could find. And the estimate, I believe Dade said, was 141,000 buys was what that had done as well. So yeah, kind of a, you know, strong, it, you know, it's always a question as they grow and add more pay-per-views, how are they going to respond? And we talked about this with All In, All Out, and then WrestleDream. And the buys have stayed pretty consistent. If you look again, the last 3 months of the year, they were trending up, and that's good money. I think overall in the stretch, the estimate it's out 406,000 buys for, you know, 20 plus million gross revenue. That's based on $50 a head. And obviously that's gross revenue, you know, the stuff they have to give out to, you know, cable distributors and anything else like that. But that's a, you know, for, it's so funny when you have people that talk about, AEW is dying and all this stuff. I mean, they did three pay-per-views in 3 months and generate gross revenue of over $20 million. That doesn't seem to be death to me, but I don't know. Maybe my definition of death is different than others.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's ridiculous conversations around AEW, and there is the truth that people are getting at is that the popularity has diminished. Certainly, we see that most pronounced in attendance. Mm-hmm. We can look at ratings too. I think we'll look at ratings. Yeah, I don't want to jump ahead here, but yeah, there are fan metrics that have been declined compared to other recent, and that's all we really got for a five-year-old company is our recent comparisons earlier in history. When it comes to pay-per-view, Tony Khan said in the most recent media call that they're looking at doing 9 to 10 this year, mm-hmm. and the history of pay-per-view tells us that, well, even if you add a lot of pay-per-views, even if you raise the price of pay-per-view, the history of pay-per-view, you know, doesn't tell us that that's a bad strategy. It tells us that the number of sales you make, you know, per show is doesn't respond that negatively to the increase in the supply of pay-per-view or even the increase in the price. The history that I read in the history of pay-per-view for wrestling is that you add more pay-per-views, you make them the same price, and you get about the same average number of buyers. Obviously, there's a point where you can't do the TNA model, and that's a totally different thing because they didn't have TV anyway. But if you did a pay per view every week, obviously you would diminish the number of buyers that you have. But as you stretch it out, you know, as you stretch out the number of pay per views you do, they haven't even changed the price, at least domestically. It's been $50 throughout the entire history of AEW. But as we've seen the price get changed by WWE over the years, that has not had a huge effect on the number of buys that you get. So right. Wrestling fans will hate me to hear me say this, but they could raise the price a little bit too and really stretch out some more revenue out of it if they wanted to.
Yep. We'll see what happens with, of course, if pay-per-views are bundled in with this impending TV deal, if they do something there. So a lot, obviously a lot in the horizon for 24. Other news of the month, or the quarter rather, AEW lost the Tuesday Night War to a very loaded up NXT in October. Of course, Tony Khan sending out several tweets before and afterward. The Curb Your Enthusiasm bald assholes comment towards Shawn Michaels and Triple H. And then afterward, kind of a tongue-in-cheek comment about it was the first show that John Cena and Undertaker had been on that had not done like a million viewers or something along those lines. And kind of one of those things just to try to save some kind of face because this was and you know, to AEW's side of things, they didn't really load up that show. I mean, it was like a normal, it was a title Tuesday. So it's a different night of the week, but they didn't all of a sudden have like, let's do, you know, Omega Danielson 2 or something like that. They basically had a fairly normal show. But NXT not only did Undertaker. They had John Cena, Cody Rhodes, somebody, a couple other people on the show. Like, it was a very main roster friendly show for that night.
And the comparison point is the same thing happened a year prior in 2022 when on a Tuesday on NXT's night, Dynamite was moved to Tuesday
right.
and handily beat NXT 752 to 676 in total viewers, and the margin was even greater in the demo. And this time, I mean, it speaks to how loaded up that show was on NXT with all the main roster. I mean, it was sort of laughable that they put like John Cena and The Undertaker and Cody Rhodes. They put like the biggest stars they had available. Now, at the same time, it's true that NXT has strengthened a lot in terms of its viewership from 2022 to 2023. So they had that going for it too. And Dynamite had diminished from 2022 to 2023 in terms of its viewership.
Yep, agreed. Some other news or notable highlights. Sting's retirement match was announced for March's Revolution in Greensboro, North Carolina. We'll talk more about that next episode. But that obviously did great with pay-per-view buys, box office, and all the like. Company signed a multi-year deal with Woo Energy. Again, they don't really announce all these sponsorship deals, but this is one they announced because it came with the pairing of Ric Flair and Tony Khan later saying that the Woo Energy deal is paying for him completely. He's not paying anything for this. You know, 2 or 3 years, I think it's a 2-year deal for Flair. Might have been a three, might be 2 years for Flair, 3 for Woo Energy, something along those lines. But, you know, it's not really.
It was explained in sort of a response to a criticism or a question about, like, you know, am I remembering that right? Because of, you know, the allegations around Flair, why are you bringing him in? And Tony's response was sort of in a way that tried to alleviate concern, is that, well, don't worry, we're not even spending the money on him.
Right. I mean, he's on TV, but we're not spending any money, so don't worry about
makes
that.
Makes it different?
Right, yeah. And he has not been on TV a lot. I was expecting him to be more involved in the Sting stuff leading up and then it become part of the storyline, but, you know, he had the edited Rampage promo that he did where he told, you know, young women to come 18 to 24 to come to his hotel room or something along those lines. It got edited out. And there just seemed to be this, you know, Tony Khan recently said that, I can't remember what the phrase was, that last media call, essentially that if you say things enough to fan, if you say things enough to me online, if enough fans say things, eventually I'm going to listen or something along those lines. If you remember that quote, we'll have that for the next one. But, you know, the sentiment around having Flair on TV was not a positive one. And it shows us this 3-month stretch really was a, you know, there's a lot of questions like, why are we doing this? And why are they doing this? And I thought, you know, December, we'll talk about the Continental Classic, that they definitely made a shift. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how much money the Woo Energy deal is for, but, you know, people, they weren't really that excited to have Flair as part of this whole thing. And I mentioned now the Sting is gone, how much we actually see him over the next, you know, year plus of this deal, whatever it is.
The rationalization that's been made to me is that, well, look, Ric Flair is a really noticeable name in business. You know, there aren't that many wrestling stars who, you know, business executives are going to recognize. Hulk Hogan is one, but they're not bringing in Hulk Hogan. I think even AEW is not going to bring in Hulk Hogan. But Ric Flair is pretty high up on the list in terms of wrestling talent who the average person on the street might recognize, mm-hmm. and that maybe that opens some doors and makes some business deals easier for them to make. I question whether that positive offsets the negative, but that's something to put on the other side of the coin.
Yeah, they could use him more for PR stuff. Like I saw Paul White and Eddie Kingston went to Yankee spring training and did some PR there. So that could be a thing where he go. I mean, because pro athletes seem to love Ric Flair, and because the whole you know, Ric Flair drip and all this, I could see them doing that. They're trying to make further kind of connections or deepen in other sports or just try to get some pictures of famous people or some sort of alignment. I could see something like that. So that's a good point. All in two, I guess we say in the AEW era, went on sale. Did Tony Khan actually revealed that it did over 200,000 buys. So that was good. He actually revealed the pay-per-view number there. And he said that 2023 was their best revenue year ever. And of course, you think about that. They had more events. They had more pay-per-views and ticket prices went up. So it should have been higher.
And they had Collision. And they had Collision, which
more money.
Tony told us at a press conference that meant more TV revenue because of the addition of Collision. So it was, as you said, more events, more pay-per-views, and more media revenue because they added a third weekly show.
Right. And we still don't know if they're running in the black yet. We assume
they're probably not. I mean, yes. I can't believe that they are. Right. Should I get into that now, or you want me to save that till later?
We'll save that for a little bit later. We'll put a pin in that. All-in tickets went on sale, all-in two, and they did, Tony Khan said it was going to be their only England show in 2024, which I took note of, and other people as well. You're wondering if they're going to do some sort of touring before or after. I guess they could in other European countries, but at this point, it appears to be a one-off, which still is a little surprising, but it seems to be, I believe it was WrestleTix that reported around 38,000 distributed at last check. So that, I don't know when that date was, but it may have been like a month ago or so, but it would look to be about 38,000 at the last check.
As of 4 days ago, 39,500.
Got it. So a slow trickle up. And obviously that show is a long ways away. I'm glad they're not consistently pushing it on every single episode and having it up on the video boards or something like that. Cause I mean, they had that stuff up in like November.
They have a sign that people could point to.
It's true. Yeah, but they're kind of just, I think they finally kind of realized or made the pivot to, we should just focus on the next pay-per-view versus focus on one that's 9 months away, 10 months away. So I noticed that was a change. But yeah, All In is on sale and going. Two notable departures from the front office, their vice president and both the chief marketing officer departing the company. The vice president is, his name is Rafe. I just talked about him the other day.
Raphael Morphy
went to the Brooklyn Nets and kind of a dream job for him, dream job scenario, because he's from that area, lives in Brooklyn or close by. So for a family decision there, that was good for him. And then also their chief marketing officer, the wife of Matt Jackson, I believe Dana, is that correct?
Yes,
she departed the company. And so there's a lot of questions about that. At this point, the Bucks had not come back yet, I don't think. So there were some questions
and
about
it. Looks like
all
Megha
that.
Parikh left AEW too. It was the chief legal officer, I think, was at least one of her titles.
Yeah, I don't know if they ever formally announced that or not, or if it was just kind of the things that was asked about and it was just talked around, which is interesting, right? Because they had it was very known these other people were leaving. But for some reason, this other one we can't get a clear answer on, which is strange.
And do you have the addition of Kosei Irby, who's now the chief operations officer and chief marketing? Well, this is what's on his LinkedIn. His title for AEW is chief operating officer, and I believe he took over many of the duties of Raphael Morphy.
I don't have excitement. Was that in the last quarter, or is that in the first quarter of this year?
That would be. I think he started in February. So
okay, that's
beyond our quarter then. Okay.
So a spoiler, everybody, for our next episode that we'll do. They do hire someone. Yeah.
Yes.
But then, so some changes there, and obviously some hirings you just alluded to in terms of IP, the Continental Classic Tournament was announced. We love IP. And the new Continental Crown was launched as a result of this. The tournament was very well received, took place over many weeks of television, and seemed to have Tony Khan making a shift, saying 1% more of a sports-related product on TV. I think people still struggle to understand completely what that means. He brought back the rankings, which we'll talk about in the next episode, but those rankings, at least as the past couple of weeks, seem to have disappeared again. So I don't know what the deal is there. But yeah, they brought this tournament, another new championship. They combined the ROH World title, this new AEW Continental title, and also the New Japan World title. And as of this past week, we learned that you can defend the titles separately. They don't all have to be part of one package, which I thought was a strange choice. So more titles, more titles, more titles. And maybe that just means more title belts sold to help the bottom line. Who knows? And we're going to talk about this in a few minutes. Ticket sales continue to struggle. It was a thread throughout this quarter, and then also into the first quarter of 2024. Was, you know, they've done more events, they've sold more tickets. However, the average, if you look at the per event, not doing that well. And some shows, 3,000, 4,000 people. I mean, the WWE WrestleMania press conference in Las Vegas, I think, may have outdrawn or come close to outdrawing the AEW Collision show that happened in Henderson, Nevada in that same weekend. And this was just a question of, they're putting on these events, but they weren't, you see some markets just dropped. They went to new markets, large venues, which, they had to, just try to fill as best they could. So that seemed to be a common theme, and you kind of put away all the bad faith argument. They definitely had an issue getting their fans out to events, and we'll talk about some other numbers that indicate some of a little bit of a shed in fans. But yeah, ticket sales not exactly a positive number for AEW.
Right. So I have here, when it comes to just isolating Dynamites, which is of course the most consistent data series that we have, because Dynamite has always been there throughout the years. And in terms of that number, we have for this quarter of Q4 2023, the average for Dynamite tickets distributed from WrestleTix is 4,500. And if you can compare that to the same quarter of a year prior, it was about 4,300. So the Dynamites were slightly up. Don't look at the slide that I gave you, because that's not updated. So it is slightly up for Dynamites, but we know going into Q1 that those numbers slide even further, and they're down substantially from the year prior.
Yep. So certainly getting people to come out to shows is an issue for sure. I'll go with some other quick highlights from the month. We had the PR, we'll go back to this in a second, but the PR disaster that was World's End when it came to Chris Jericho and the Tony Khan press conference afterwards, that was definitely not a great way to enter 2024. Ronda Rousey made her debut for Ring of Honor an unheralded one-off in November. It was one of those things where I talked about this in the year-end review series I did, how it was pointed out, I think it was actually from Rich from Voice of Wrestling, pointed out just how it was just, it didn't mean anything. Like, there was no buzz for it. Obviously, it was a surprise, but it was in Stockton, California, if I remember right. And it was just
Marina Shafir, right?
Yeah, it was a kind of a favor to her, but still, like, yeah. If you think back to, I mean, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that, she was arguably one of the most notable and known sports stars in the world. I mean, she was, because of the UFC run, and then obviously she went to WWE. That was a big deal the first time around. I mean, she was a mega star. And then she came back for that second run and just, it basically just evaporated all of this, this goodwill she had built up and just people actually caring. And then, again, it was a surprise. People didn't know she was going to be there. And I remember seeing a shot of the stands, because people usually leave after the main taping, sticking around for Ring of Honor. I mean, it was a lot of fans dressed as empty seats, put it that way. And Ronda Rousey came out, and again, it was just a one-off and that's it. But we had one of the biggest stars on your secondary brand, and I don't think it meant anything, which is just surprising. Surprising, Kenny Omega versus MJF for the AEW world title was put on free TV with about 3 days notice, which surprised a lot of people. They announced that for Connecticut, for a Collision episode. They announced it, I believe, I don't even know if they announced it on Wednesday's Dynamite. I think they may have announced it like the next day, if I remember right. A big surprise, because that was kind of one of those, you look at these at that point, kind of these key matches you put on a shelf that could headline a pay-per-view. And that was leading into the MJF Jay White match at Full Gear. It was just kind of if you had kind of looked in a year prior and said, which of these is going to be on pay-per-view, you'd obviously say the Omega match, but that's not the way it turned out. Again, with relatively no build, just happened to be Kenny Omega was trying to prevent his win streak, or his title reign streak, or the length of days rather, was trying to prevent MJF from overtaking him. That was kind of the angle. So it was just a surprising move there. Being the Elite wrapped up on YouTube. Tony Khan said Brian Danielson will remain with AEW in spirit after his run ends. So we'll see what happens there. The company announced 8 Canadian dates for 2024. Those begin this weekend. Ring of Honor Final Battle still around, and they moved to streaming only for their specials. Looks like that's going to be paving the way for Honor Club again, essentially just a streaming service. No more pay-per-views, because they've shifted the pay-per-view focus over to AEW, which makes a lot of sense. Did just under 2,000 people in attendance in Garland, Texas. Not great there. They announced a new women's TV title for Ring of Honor. The lawyer, Stephen P. New, I believe, confirmed that CM Punk and Ace Steel are under lifetime NDAs regarding AEW and the All Out fight. Again, this murky legal morass that surrounds AEW, all these NDAs and who can talk about what. And that led Chris Jericho going on Twitter, going on X, saying that he had never signed an NDA. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm looking forward to the book and the podcast coming out in like 15, 20 years when we're older and grayer, and finally getting the details and all that. Again, Tony Khan saying he's going to lean more into sports-based wrestling after the Continental Classic quote-unquote experiment. AEW was part of a $1 million merchandise donation to Toys for Tots, and then the company and CFX reached a settlement in the much-discussed Luchasaurus mask lawsuit. So that was kind of all the big headlines and minor ones, but I said I want to go back that that PR disaster that was World's End. That was a pay-per-view that overall I think was – actually, I don't think I know – it was kind of seen as one of AEW's, the fan base's least favorite pay-per-views, I think, from the angles on the show, but also just this weird situation that happened, really developed during that Saturday with Chris Jericho and these essentially allegations / non-allegations, because it wasn't officially actually kind of put out there about something that happened with Kylie Rae, I think, back in 2019. She did not officially say this happened on this date or so on. She made a statement after, but
she did like a tweet.
She liked a tweet. That's what kind of started this whole thing. And then other people that heard stuff kind of put things out there, and it was this, it became a huge firestorm during the day. And Jericho, I'd never addressed it. Tony Khan after the event at the press conference, either forgot or just did not care that he had Tony Storm's fur hat on, this weird hat and wacky sunglasses, was answering these serious questions about these allegations and answering them looking completely ridiculous. And
credit though to Adam Hopkins of PR with AEW for taking the hat and glasses from him.
Yes,
before he took more questions on the subject.
Yes, that was a good move by Adam Hopkins for sure. I mean, earning his money, learning from the WWE days and all that. It was Yeah, it was just it was a moment where, you know, it ended. That was AEW's last event of the year.
Yes,
and it was just one of those things where, you know, it hasn't had, in terms of the company, it has not had like a residual effect, I don't think, other than there was still this kind of this chemical trail, so to speak, around Jericho. I noticed it. I mean, if you watched Dynamite this past week, you couldn't help but notice people booing. And people were booing him.
This is for what you were there live for,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And do you think there was still a negative reaction for Jericho at that time?
Yeah, you could hear during the match itself, the tag team match, you could definitely hear some boos. They weren't overwhelmed, but you could hear some. And also apathy as well. And that's almost worse in some ways. But during the promo he did backstage, when it was Jericho and Jericho and Hookup on the screen, there was noticeable booing, especially from one pocket of the crowd that you couldn't help but hear on the broadcast. I watched it afterward too, and they didn't try to edit it out. And you could see Jericho kind of react to it, like a little bit of a surprise. And there's definitely this, it can't just be there because they're sick of Jericho. It feels like it is something related to everything that happened and these unanswered questions that happened late December. And
let's mention on the pay-per-view itself, which I'm looking at cage matches, is the lowest rated AEW pay-per-view in history. But besides that, Jericho in his match, he was in like an 8-man tag or something, right? There were really strong chants towards him. Mm-hmm. There were NDA chants, right? And there was a strong reaction where this pay-per-view crowd, which is going to be your most diehard aware crowd, is really reacting negatively because of these, I don't know if you want to call it news, but at least the chatter that's going on that weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I guess, you know, it kind of wrap up the year in Tony Khan, because I know that, you know, you had aired your frustrations on Paul and Thurston before in terms of just his kind of how Tony Khan has answered questions in the past, these long looping things and, you know, not wanting to really be on calls anymore and so on. Then you had this thing. What do you think about looking back to the fourth quarter, kind of the 2023 of Tony Khan? What's your overall thoughts?
I think so. This interaction in this press conference in particular, I think it's another example of the lack of self-awareness that I think he has when he handles himself in these situations. In that, for one thing, yes, he didn't realize that he was, I don't know if he didn't realize or didn't care, like you said, that he was wearing a funny hat and glasses while he was taking questions about a very serious subject like sexual harassment in the workplace. Now remember, this is December 30th. So the Janelle Grant lawsuit against WWE and Vince and Laurinaitis has not come out yet.
Right.
That's later in January. But his part of his response, he obviously he got three questions about this and he kept sticking to his talking points that AEW is a safe workplace. I have an open door. There's a discipline committee. He would not answer questions about whether there had ever been an investigation related to sexual misconduct related to Chris Jericho. But I think, for your question in particular about just how Tony handles media appearances in general, I think he's doing less of them now, which if he's not going to say that much, I think is advisable. He's really willing, which is in a good natured way. I appreciate that he's willing to go out and talk to media and make himself available, but he's not really willing to say that much, especially around important topics and around questions that I think it's really important that he be asked. So, and I think there's just a lack of awareness about how to handle these situations and maybe about how he comes across. And I know he's got a team of public relations people around him who support him. And I don't know, obviously we have no idea what their meetings are like and what kind of guidance they're trying to give him. But it's just, I think it contributes negatively to AEW's brand and how it presents itself sometimes when, you know, sort of, I don't know, I think like every 2 months or so we have a situation where I don't think he handles a really important question in a good way. Another smaller example of this, which has kind of been affected by the fact that they've hired Jennifer Pepperman as a writer, who is a woman, where he's been asked questions about whether, you know, who are the female voices who are contributing to creative, and he'll mention Madison Rayne, and he'll mention Sarah Stock, and then he'll go on a long list of men who contribute to creative, sure, and the creative process and their producers, and it's just like I don't know, like there needs to be an expression of I don't understand why you're asking that question. I think that's a really really good question, which he often does say, but tell me why you understand why that's a good question. Tell me why you understand why it's important to have female voices contributing to creative. You know, tell me why you understand why it's really important to have a strong policy against sexual misconduct in the workplace. Just things like that.
Right. And I think that the thing that always stands out to me, and I've mentioned this before, is, you know, there's this template of this major organization and some of the issues and errors and things they've made, not just before the Janelle Grant, not just because of the Janelle Grant lawsuit, but I mean, there's been countless stories about in the years, different issues with WWE and other organizations as well. And to me, you know, he's got the opportunity and the organization's opportunity to truly be better. And I think that's that thing where if you're trying to lure free agents, if you're trying to, you know, the conversations that people have about cross brand, about how are things over there, you know, and I think it's you want people to have really good things to say about you and be honest about that. And not just because they're saying it publicly in an interview or saying it because they think they should, or they want to keep their job at that, the stuff that people don't hear in public. And they're like, this is a good organization. This is why. And to come out with this stuff and things that aren't that hard, right? It's not that hard to be an organization. Say, here's our policy against sexual harassment and keep our worker and employees safe, not just wrestlers, but backstage personnel, all this. There's a number they can call. Here's the procedure. You know, here's a manual we can say. This is what we say, you know, with a, you know, number blocked out or whatever, but, you know, just like,
or say that we do have a way that employees and talent can provide anonymous complaints, which I'm told that they do. And right. I think that's why not share that?
Yeah. And who is the person heading this up? Right. Who is there a person there? Is it a person that works in the con organization that deals with issues with the NFL and so on? And I've said this before too. They have the great fortune of being able to leverage experience from all their time with the NFL and the soccer league and everything else with how this happens in other organizations. What are best practices across the league? It's not just because sexual harassment isn't just happening in pro wrestling. It happens everywhere. I mean, in sports news, you hear these things all the time. Owners have been essentially kicked out of the league or essentially forced to sell because of this, because of sexual issues, harassment issues. There's a huge thing with the Dan Snyder, the Dallas Mavericks had a huge scandal 2 years ago, I think it was. Mark Cuban is still there, but there are some changes, some major changes there. And it's, you know, every organization has the responsibility to do this stuff. And again, they have the advantage of being able to say, to leverage this and use this experience, saying, because of this experience, all these organizations, here's what we have. So, So,
and I did ask him, just to be complete with the information, I did ask him in the, I think the most recent media call, who is on the discipline committee. And he said, it's two lawyers, and it's Brian Danielson. So we don't know who the two lawyers are, but there's two lawyers, and Brian Danielson are in charge of that. And he said they do give them training about how to handle sexual misconduct. But I do think, you know, especially since the Janelle Grant lawsuit came out, people are thinking about this kind of thing even more within wrestling. And I think, yes, that's a different company. And when he's been asked about the Vince story, he said, I can't speak to it, which in a sense I understand. But the better question is, there's clearly a long history of sexual misconduct in pro wrestling culture. And that's what's happening in WWE. I can't necessarily expect you to speak to, but there's a culture where this is happening. I think it's safe to say at a disproportionate rate. Obviously it happens in all sorts of workplaces, but it's happening probably at a disproportionate rate in the pro wrestling industry. You're in the pro wrestling industry. And how do you think about that? And how do you handle that? Because that's clearly a thing that has been handed down inherently throughout the history of wrestling. And it's still happening in the years of 2019 to 2024. And so it's affecting AEW.
Let's go on some other AEW stuff from the quarter. So they had 28 total events. They had 13 live Dynamite Rampage tapings. They had 12 live Collisions / Battle of the Belts / Rampage tapings. They had one streaming special, which was Ring of Honor Final Battle. So actually 29, if you include Ring of Honor, 28 AEW proper. And then they had three pay-per-views, Wrestle Dream, Full Gear, and then World's End, as we mentioned. We'll get some of the numbers there in a second for attendance. Some new IP, because we love talking about IP. Wrestle Dream, of course, World's End, the Continental Classic, the Continental Crown. And also they trademarked East-West Express, which they have not used as of yet. I don't know if it's a tag team or some sort of, you know, do their own bullet train match or something like that across this great country of ours, and an Amtrak Downeaster, I don't know, an Amtrak Alexa, but we'll see what happens there. A couple quotable quotes. There was a report that this was interesting. A CW executive approached Tony Khan about doing a Ring of Honor TV deal in 2022. And he decided.
And Tony confirmed that on the record too.
He did.
There was a conversation. Yeah.
He did. Yes. So it is interesting because he, for a lot of reasons, one, happened in Los Angeles. And he said the guy was very nice. I remember that the person he talked from CW, but essentially, you know, he followed this up, which I thought was interesting on that one, that the calls that he did, I think this might've been the World's End call, if I remember it. He talked about wanting to hold it as a card for his AEW rights negotiation, essentially not wanting to get hit the RMH deal, the ROH TV rights hooked up with somebody else, because he really wants to use this as leverage, essentially saying he's going to try to package these together, and he views Ring of Honor as a very valuable asset in doing that. And I think many people kind of questioned why that was, because to me, and I've talked about this on my podcast before, is if you have the opportunity to build relationships at these other companies, that's a great thing. And he's shown great loyalty to WBD. He's mentioned it before, he wants to be with them, even though, you know, we kind of, without saying it outright, saying that I'm going to shop these around, saying that there is lots of interest, massive interest in AEW, and he keeps bringing up Ring of Honor. But I'm surprised that he would not take the opportunity to bring Ring of Honor to the CW. Again, even if it's a 3-year, a shorter deal, just to start building a relationship and expose an audience somewhere else. Instead, it's on Honor Club, where, you know, he has not given an update quote in terms of how many subscribers. I think the last one we knew, which I think was the last time you and I talked, was like 12,000 or 15,000, something like that. So not a lot of people. And it may have gone up after Final Battle, because the stream specials are on there now. But still, it's not. I'm just surprised he would not take that opportunity to expand. And WWE is there with NXT now, so you know.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he tried to get a Ring of Honor deal somehow, right? Because there was sort of discussion and expectation a lot, you know, that was allowed to be built towards the notion that, you know, Ring of Honor is eventually going to have a weekly TV show. And I don't, do you remember the I don't know what it, when it was, I think it was after a Ring of Honor show. Anyway, he was doing a press conference afterward, and somebody asked him about, you know, a TV deal. And he filibustered for like 4 minutes before finally saying it's on Honor Club or something. Yeah. But, you know, so he has been so loyal to WBD, which is, I think, most pronounced in a response to a question that I asked him on a call about. It was just after the news that SmackDown was leaving. Fox had come out, and maybe that was going to USA by then. And so I asked him, hey, look, Fox doesn't have wrestling now. Do you see Fox as a potential partner maybe for one of your TV shows? And he talked about how loyal he was to WBD, so loyal to the extent that he would take less money to stay with WBD. Now, this is at least the fall that he's saying this, I think. Mm-hmm. And since then, you know, we still don't have any TV deal done domestically, any renewal for this deal that's going to expire. It's going to expire at the end of the year.
Yeah,
I know there's been conflicting reports whether it's going to expire in the fall or whether it's going to expire at the end of the year. Based on my reading of the tea leaves of comments that he's made, I think it's going to expire at the very end of the year. But anyway, whenever it's going to expire, there's no deal done yet, and we're under a year here. And I think that fact tells you that, well, maybe WBD isn't being as loyal or as favorable to AEW as AEW is being to WBD. Not that WBD is going to cancel them and throw them in the bin, but they're not ready to give AEW the deal that AEW wants and feels that it's worthy of and that it can get. So I think, you know, maybe I think Tony's probably overestimating the value of Ring of Honor. This is going to be a supplemental show. Right, I think there's minimal value even in the library based on how much it would cost to make that library usable. Much of that library, I think, is of low enough production value that I don't think it's, I mean, I can't imagine those early Ring of Honor shows appearing on a major streaming service that are taped with a camcorder, not to mention some of the content on them. Yeah. I think the fact that there is no TV deal done today tells you that, well, maybe WBD is maybe lowballing them a little bit, or it's not giving them the deal that they think that they can get. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that one, maybe even two of the AEW weekly TV shows will end up outside of the WBD universe, while maybe WBD keeps one, and maybe the streaming rights do end up on Max. So there's sort of four sets of rights here, three shows and one streaming set of rights.
That's very possible. Yeah, we still don't know when that exclusive negotiating window is up. You know, we knew that because Nick Khan with WWE year prior was very open in saying that, of course, on investors' calls and after, saying it ends, you know, it starts right at WrestleMania and then it ends. He's like, he didn't have an exact date, but at least he gave you a month time frame. He's like, oh, it's a couple more weeks here or something like that. And was very open about it. And part of that was obviously to send signals out to other people that say, oh, these rights are coming up. Let's, you know, not like let's get ready, but other, just so there's no ambiguity where somebody's like, oh, I wish I knew. Right. And so I wonder, because we haven't really heard much about anything about it, you know? So
he said after Revolution that they're still in a exclusive window. They're still in their exclusive window as of Revolution.
Right.
So, I mean, like, which made me wonder, like, you're still in the exclusive window, or you're still in the exclusive window with WBD now, so that which means for people who might not understand, it means you can't talk to Fox or Amazon or whoever. You can only talk to your current partner, which is, I mean, we're at not that much time left. So I don't know, maybe it's the last 6 months of the deal or something.
Yeah.
Anybody's guess.
And you look by comparison when WBD announced their deals. I mean, there is a long ways to go from when they announced to when the actual happens, to give people an idea of like, how long it takes. You know, for us, it's as simple as flipping a channel. For them, it's flipping infrastructure. You know, you're going to work with new partners, new expectations.
Mark Shapiro said they're turnkey. They can make a deal the night before.
That's right. That's right. Mark Shapiro. Yeah. Hate those. He doesn't like those tape machines.
Right. All the extra he doesn't. No, he hates tape machines. But to make a comparison about the prior term in 2018, that deal for WWE and AEW didn't exist. In 2018, WWE made its deal 18 months in advance of when its current deal is going to expire.
Mm-hmm.
And WWE has now finally finished their deals with like, I mean, just over a year. And in the case of Raw, a lot less than a year. And AEW is now under 12 months here. So, right. Yeah.
Yeah. 9 months. Yeah. Unbelievable. So we'll see what happens there. Notable signings and departures during the final quarter. Of course, Adam Copeland, AKA Edge, Ric Flair, as we mentioned, Will Ospreay officially signed his multi-year contract that kicked off in February. Katsuyori Shibata officially signed a deal. I don't think we've actually seen him since he signed that deal. Dralistico signed a deal. Mariah May from Stardom. Kota Ibushi officially signed a deal. And then we saw some departures, which included The Bunny. Notably, Jade Cargill departed the company despite what Tony Khan said, two quote-unquote very big offers. Zach Clayton, VSK, Brock Anderson, QT Marshall, who eventually returned to the company. We'll talk more about him next episode. And then Sean Spears and then Andrade, even though I think they probably could extend him due to injury time, just were at the point where they're like, we're good. And I would not be surprised to see, you know, perhaps Miro goes the same route. And some of these guys that just are clearly not happy and not really on board. And now you have all these new toys with Okada and Ospreay and these other guys that are ready. So at this point, you know, you might as well just kind of cut bait and we'll see what happens. But yeah, I mean, we have some big money deals. Copeland probably didn't come cheap. Will Ospreay didn't come cheap. And obviously, you know, Okada, we'd hear about during the next quarter, but they're certainly investing in their stars. And that includes people already in a contract like Moxley and Jericho and some of these other guys, the Elite, that signed new deals. So yeah, he's definitely not cheaping out when it comes to top tier talent. And we'll see when, you know, the next big, I don't know what the next big, you know, WWE free agent is. It sounds like, you know, Drew McIntyre is probably going to re-sign given all the angles and things he's doing. But we, you know, it's one of the things about kind of is a bummer about wrestling and it's different than traditional sports that we don't have free agency dates. You know, we don't know who's going to be coming up on what dates and it takes a lot to kind of get there. And so we really don't know, but yeah,
that's a job. Maybe some reporters should dig more deeply into that. And I mean, there has been some reporting around like so-and-so's contract is coming up. There has been more of that in recent years than there ever has been in years prior.
Yeah.
But that is something, you know, I think about as a reporter, like that's something we could dig into and that's a goal that we could try to accomplish is to get some more transparency around what the timelines are for talent deals and even what the compensation is like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fightful has done a really good job. Sean, yeah. He actually just will tweet out, if your contract's coming up, let me know.
It's a talent's advantage to have that out there.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And that's the benefit. And you see, they get a lot of exclusives on, so-and-so's deal with Impact is coming up. And then other people in the industry that might want to hire them are like, oh, this is coming up. They can actually bid, and that creates a nice marketplace for everyone.
I wonder how the company who currently has that talent under contract feels when they suspect that you've leaked the term of your deal, and if that makes them, you know, feel like they're like you know, if that
violates something,
the relationship at all, or is there anything legal there? Yeah, I don't know. So I realize that could be an issue, but the more transparency that there can be, all other things being equal, that's the best thing for talent.
Yeah. Some notable injuries. Sammy Guevara suffered a concussion. And again, kind of very uneven record for him in terms of being available. Darby Allin, yet another injury. This suffered at Nitro Circus. I've never been to a Nitro Circus event, but watching the...
Is that WCW?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's an off-brand WCW.
WCW pay-per-view?
I saw a lot of people would say WCW is a circus at some points. But yeah, and Darby, and this goes to the... Dave is kind of questioned when Darby said he was going to climb Mount Everest, why Tony Khan allows Darby Allin, who's a very popular star for them, to do things like jump from skateboard off this massive ramp, and you know, he fractured his shoulder. It just absolutely crazy. Brian Danielson fractures orbital bone, a lot of injuries, key injuries to top guys. And then Danielson, of course, was out for basically 2 months and then came back because he's absolutely insane. MJF banged up, and he would work through World's End and then has not been heard from since. This is his birthday today as we record this, actually. Juice Robinson, back injury. And then Kenny Omega, one of the company's top stars, suffering diverticulitis. And we do not know when we're going to see him at some point. It could be months, but I want to say they've kind of moved on, but they really haven't missed a beat. You know, they brought in some of these new talents and kind of the timing actually worked out pretty well in that they kind of give these other guys a chance, like the Okadas and Will Ospreys and other, and even like, you know, Samoa Joe and some of these guys kind of a chance to breathe a little bit and kind of establish themselves. And when all this talent comes back, it's been talked about a lot. If they can stay relatively injury free, this is a pretty great talent roster for the rest of this year. And it's going to be up to Khan and whoever you entrust to help out with creative to figure out a way to really maximize it. There's no excuses as far as the talent, top to bottom. This is almost as good as it gets if you're really into the in-ring.
No, I mean, you have Kota Ibushi here. No one's seen Kota Ibushi since when's the Blood and Guts match, probably?
He had that match in, was it DDT, where he basically worked on like a broken ankle? Who knows? I mean, that was kind of one of those deals when he signed. It's like, why are you doing, like, we saw him in Blood and Guts and saw, like, he hasn't looked good since he's been back. And
he looked like a husk of Kota Ibushi. But you have Rule Ospreay, and spoiler for Q1, you're going to have Kazuchika Okada, Mercedes Moné. And, I mean, there's, for the fact that you've lost CM Punk, you've got a lot of other good talent moves. I think talent could be used more efficiently here. I don't know if you need everybody who you've signed here, and I don't know if you're using everybody as efficiently as you could, and I bet there's a lot of talent who feel the same way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you've got really kind of a dream talent roster here, you know, mm-hmm. And it's sort of surprising that WWE got none of those three we just mentioned, right, in terms of Okada, Ospreay, or didn't bring back Mercedes/Sasha Banks, right. And let all them go to AEW.
Yeah, and I think part of that speaks to, and talent has talked about this either directly or indirectly, is that they like the flexibility and being able to, you know, Okada does not have to move to the States. He can, if they don't want to, he has a young family, he can stay in Japan and do, you know, trips back and forth. You know, same with Ospreay, and, you know, they can, if they figure things out ahead of time, which, you know, Khan has not exactly been known to be great for. You know, hear all these stories about talent not really knowing what they're doing until the day of, and, you know, whether that applies to everyone or not, I don't know, but there's been, you know, some stuff out there. So yeah, it's they have the flexibility, and talent really like working other places. You know, they like the ability to, I can do this here, I can do this here, I can do this here, and I can stay busy and I can earn more. Where, you know, across the street, so to speak, in the big ivory tower, they don't let talent do that. And it's a very distinct difference, because right now they're the biggest player in the industry in WWE, but they don't let their talent work elsewhere, which I think works to their advantage. But you see some talents who are like, I want that freedom. I want to be able to do things I want to do and not have to ask for permission every time. So we'll see. I don't see WWE changing course, but you also have to kind of balance that with making, if you're paying.
You're talking about Charlie Dempsey worked All Japan Pro Wrestling.
That's true. He did come to mind. Right. And I think Trick Williams may have worked Booker T's promotion. Yeah.
Okay.
But I, you know, you have to kind of go with, it's a case of making sure that you're getting the most, whoever's paying you the most, which in this case, I assume is AEW, that they're getting the most out of it, you know? So that's it's also added headaches as well. Someone wants to be, oh, I want to go work this CMLL date. And you're like, eh, I don't know about this. And someone getting a little upset about that. So it's just kind of another thing to tackle and manage that WWE doesn't have to do.
Yeah. All I right. mean, it's part of a spending story too, that I think we'll get to in a moment.
Yes. All right. Let's go over some of the numbers from this document, which you can get on WrestleNomics.com right now if you're a subscriber, and provides a little bit more color what we're talking about. So screenshot one, or slide one rather, is average U.S. TV.
These are charts. These are not screenshots.
Sorry.
Oh, no.
Yeah. P2 viewers.
These are Excel spreadsheet charts.
Yes. Brought to life. And so average U.S. TV P2 viewership. And so P2 is live viewing plus 2 days on DVR. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Live same day. Well, did you say plus two?
Yes.
P2 just means people age 2 and older.
Oh, just 2.
That's age. Whenever you see a number it's people age two or plus.
I hope no 2-year-olds are watching AEW programming. No offense.
If they are, they're being counted.
I always thought P2, God, what an idiot I am. I always thought it was the amount of days, they count like DVR viewership in the days after. Is that a different term?
That's DVR plus 3, plus 7.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Or it's Live plus seven, live plus three.
Got it. Okay. We never really hear those numbers, or at least I don't. Yeah.
It's, yeah. I mean, I don't see it as that meaningful. I don't know. I mean, yeah. It's maybe higher for AEW than other things, but yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Huh. Learn something new every day. Okay. So Dynamite, when it comes to year over year, 828,000 was the average and for this quarter, and it was down 10% from the prior year, 921,000. AEW Rampage down. It was 335,000 was their average for the last quarter, down 25% from 450,000 average in Q4 of 2022. Obviously, Collision still has not hit that 1 year mark, but that's going to be a great day when you can compare year to year for AEW Collision. We still get some time to go, but the day is fast approaching. Average 443,000 viewers in Q4. And then compared to TBS and TNT originals, which I'm sure many of our listeners take in on a regular basis, only down 5%. So 754,000 was the average there, down from 795,000%. So if you look straight at the numbers, AEW has had some shed when it comes to their weekly programming, Dynamite, Rampage especially. But a 10% drop is still, you know, it's still significant. It's you know, half of what the stations run, but still, I think it's significant. What say you?
Well, so did we go over the demo yet? We did not, did we?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Well, in terms of total viewership, it's down 10%. And I think so if you're listening to Tony Khan talk about viewership and the fact that Dynamite is down year over year, he might tell you that, well, that's better than the rate of cord cutting. Well, what one thing that is relevant to the sort of headwind that all TV is up against, the fact that there's less and less access over time to traditional television. Yes, so of course, that's absolutely true. That is a headwind that all traditional television programs are up against. When we look at just the TBS and TNT originals, which in Q4 will include a lot of NBA basketball, that is down 5% in terms of total viewership. Now, if we talk about cord cutting, how much is cord cutting down? Comparing December 2023 to December 2022, that's a year, multi-channel was down. That means traditional TV subscribers. Multi-channel was down 5.6%. So that is less worse than the decline of Dynamite in Q4 year over year, which is down 10%. Again, pay TV, cable / satellite / yes, this includes your live YouTube TV. This includes your Hulu Live TV, yes, it includes all that. Total multi-channel is down 5.5% in December of 2023 versus December of the prior year, which is not as bad as Dynamite is down. Now, if you really want to reach for your excuses here, you could say, well, look, that's access. That's reach. How about actual consumption? And actual consumption, I'm sure I don't have those numbers in front of me, but the actual consumption is even more negative for TV viewership generally, you know, not just because you don't have access to it, because you're just, you know, there's other things. There's TikTok, there's YouTube, there's fighting with people on Twitter that fights for your time.
Exactly. Let's go to then the demo. So the key demo, 18 to 49, AEW Dynamite year over year was down 9%, 0.28 to compared to a 0.30. AEW Rampage down 18%, 0.11. to 0.13 year over year. Collision finished up for the Q4 at a 0.13. And then compared to TBS and TNT originals only, they were down 6%. So 0.21 compared to a 0.23 the year prior. What did you glean from this?
A similar story, I'm sure, because we're looking at a younger section of the audience. Now we're looking only at people 18 to 49. We're excluding everybody 50 plus, who's a much more stable, undying cable TV viewer. So I'm sure if I had data that told me what's the rate of decline with cord cutting for people who are 18 to 49, it would be worse than that 5.5% that it is generally. Is it worse than 9%? Who knows? But 9% is you know, it's flat at best, you know, if you were to adjust it for all these external headwinds. Rampage is down substantially though, 18%. I don't think there's any way to spin that. Rampage is not genuinely down in this quarter. And if you look at the cable originals that are on TBS and TNT, those are only down 6%. And those have got the same problems that everybody else has got.
Yep. Again, I would not be surprised to see Rampage become a third hour of
Now,
Dynamite.
right. Now, does that mean that Dynamite isn't a valuable program? No, it doesn't mean that Dynamite's not a valuable program. Of course, Dynamite's a very valuable program. Where does it rank? Which maybe I should have a slide for, which I don't, shame on me. Dynamite still ranks among the top five cable originals, at least. It's sometimes number one, depending on what the competition is and the seasonality. And that's what makes Dynamite, these other programs are another story, but that's what makes Dynamite a very valuable program that you can be pretty confident is going to get a good rights upgrade for.
Right. They may not win the night, but they're at least compete for it almost every single Wednesday night. It's not like all of a sudden they're taking a tumble down to 15th or something like that. You're right. It's almost always competing for that, that top spot. If it doesn't get the top spot. And that's a,
in terms of the average, I can tell you for this quarter, the average cable original rank for Dynamite in Q4 was number four. And you know what it was a year ago in Q4, 2022? Four. You know what it was a year before that in 2021? Four. And it was 10 in 2020, Q4.
Consistency.
So stable, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Let's go to live events, because this, again, this kind of is a story we've talked about a lot for Q4 and AEW tickets and not being able to get enough fans to come out. So they held total events, 28 events in 2023. That was up 8 from the year prior, up 11 from the year prior to that. And an average was 91,000.
No, I have not given you the most up-to-date
slides.
Oh,
sorry.
Here.
Why don't you provide this data? That's
yes.
What you told me not to look at this.
So if we're talking about in terms of the total number of tickets distributed, which I'm sure correlates strong with the number of tickets sold, we don't have that data, of course, but we have tickets distributed from WrestleTix, 129,000 in Q4, which is far higher than the prior two years, but that's by virtue of there being a collision show, basically. Mm-hmm. So they're running a lot more. They ran 8 more events in this quarter than they did in the year prior. In terms of average for Dynamite, which is the really consistent data series that we look at, that I think is a good test of how popular or not popular this product is at the moment. You look at Dynamite because it's got a long, long history. They run it every week. There's 13 Dynamites in just about every quarter here. And that averaged, I think we mentioned this already, but that averaged 4,500, which was up slightly from the year prior. That averaged 4,300. It's stable for now. As we know here in the future, things slide a little bit further.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, it sounds like, how do you solve that? It's you have to give something that people want to see and come out to. And they double their amount of events, basically.
But it could be the weather. It could be that, you know, that, look, it's really nice out. How can you, it's the daylight savings you have to keep in mind.
Right, right.
You know, what is the Paul Bosch story that Dave tells is that the reason why he didn't draw is that you didn't give people a show that they wanted to pay to see.
Right.
And what's happening here is just, I believe, is just, it's the content and the star power. And the volume it isn't a non-factor. I think the fact that you're going back to towns more frequently and that you're running more events and that you're comparing these market-to-market comparisons against your first or second time in the market. And now you're not as fresh as you once were. And AEW isn't as hot as it once was.
Yeah. And, you know, I think also things like, you know, announcing cards ahead of time so people kind of know, oh, we should go to see this and this. I think, you know, I'd be interested to have a survey of AEW ticket buyers in terms of, you know, when did you make your decision to go? And I assume most probably at least weeks in advance. And I'm sure there's some that are, the influence to buy is I'm going to go because it's in town. You know, it comes maybe.
But what
once.
About the marketing? People listening are shouting at their podcast.
The
right
marketing.
Now. But what
the
about the local marketing?
Right. Right.
I
yeah.
think that's a very minor factor. I think sure that's a thing that you should put time and resources into. But I don't think it makes the difference that we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's so hard. Like, it really is. Get just really motivating people to go, and that it is going to be better than sitting on their couch and watching TV or going to the movies. I mean, I dealt with this when we worked in hockey is there. Sometimes it's the date that works. It's the a promotion that you're doing that works. It is the opponent that works, or it's a Saturday night in February and people want to get out of the house and want to go see a hockey game, you know, and
sometimes you got Wayne Gretzky.
Sometimes you get Wayne Gretzky. Sometimes you have mullet night, which is always an instant sellout for us. Yes, it was. Yeah, big one. Bobbleheads, things like that. Maybe AEW should start doing giveaways on the way in, like bobblehead giveaways, t-shirts, things like that. Those always bring people in. We would have no problem selling out. That could be a
Trying a
thing for
wrestling show after the, oh wait,
us.
what do you think about this point that you've been to a number of AEW events, and I think a lot of TV events, maybe more TV events. I've mostly been to pay-per-views.
All TV events except for one pay-per-view. Yeah.
Okay, so is it a long show?
Yes.
It does that make an average, fan, ticket buyer less excited about the next time? Because my God, they kept me in the building for like however long, 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, I think it depends on. I think it depends on how badly they want to see what is like on a Rampage, for example. Because it's not like they're saying you have to stay,
Right,
and
you
it's
could leave
not
at
like
any time.
right, and it's not like you're they're saying we have a dark match main event of Kenny Omega versus Will Ospreay that's not going to be seen on camera, right? I mean, they don't do anything really like that.
And
That.
there's matches beforehand taped for Ring of Honor
They
or
did, yeah,
what?
this time. So the last time it went, so before Blood and Guts, it was just a couple dark matches. And then this time around, they taped like four nothing matches for Ring of Honor. But it wasn't like you had to be there. So, people like myself and people that are kind of like completists that want to see kind of the whole
But there is
thing.
a
But
time on your ticket that says show starts at 6 or whatever.
I think it was 7 or 7:30. 7:30 is when
Okay.
it started. So yeah, 7:30 till 11:30. Yeah, that's a solid chunk of time.
Now you got work in the morning.
A lot of people, that's the other thing as well. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people didn't leave for Rampage this time around, where
Okay.
for Blood and Guts, a decent amount of people did, but it wasn't. You always notice by how dark it is in that lower bowl, and I didn't notice any like darkening of it. You notice that on TV a lot more. But yeah, I think it's a lot of factors. But when I think the size of buildings they run has always been interesting to me, and they're kind of going back to some of the smaller venues, more college style things like that, except for if they, unless they have something of note, being the big business thing with Mercedes Moné. They drew a crowd for that in Boston. They had Blood and Guts, as we mentioned, in July, and that drew really well because that was an attraction the first time it had been there. And before, they had ran the Agganis, which is a small, smaller college arena. So yeah, it's I'm interested to see how things kind of go in this next run. It's easy when you're kind of on a little bit of a heater now with your bigger cities and you got some interesting stuff coming up. But if they're running Wheeling, West Virginia in June, how's that going to go on a Wednesday or a Saturday, right? I mean, there's
Hey,
just
West
so
Virginia is a hotbed. If you look at Google Trends, which we're going to talk about in a moment, West Virginia is always number one. West Virginia, Mississippi, they index highly when it comes to most wrestling search terms.
Yeah, very true, very true.
For what that's worth,
I'm thinking about the quote
which
for
is maybe not much.
the Pollock and Thurston quote, the MJF line that's in there about the Google
Yeah.
Trends and all that as well. But also, yeah, ticket prices as well. That's a factor too. If you're bringing a family, you're going by yourself, the idea of trying to get more and more fans in for a lesser ticket price, and I don't. There's a whole lot of factors. There's not one answer.
Content. It's the content is the
Content.
biggest factor.
Khantent, content. Exactly. So let's round things out with YouTube views. We're down slightly from the queue before.
Yeah, I don't want to concentrate too much on this. So there's YouTube views, 172 million in the quarter, which is, so we look at the same quarter the prior year, is that's way up from 111 that they did in the year prior. What does that mean? I don't know. Do they make money on YouTube? Sure. Is it a lot of money? Not much. Hundred and I always use as a rule of thumb. This is just my rule. Nobody, I is that like per thousand, maybe make about a dollar. Maybe it's a little bit more if you're, I don't know, maybe you have some special deal with YouTube. Like, I don't know if AEW does, but, and a lot of this traffic is coming from overseas, so the CPMs are going to be all over the place depending on what the region is. But that, I figured in my financial estimate that maybe they make just under $1 million for the year on YouTube. So compare that to like the, I think like $70 million they're making for a year for their domestic TV deal. It's a small drop in the bucket.
Gotcha. And then Google Web Search Index. You want to go over this?
The index, which is not a number of searches, but it is an index compared to like whatever the peak is over the course of the timeline, which in this case is going back to Q1 of 2019. It's at a 55.7, which is up from the prior year. What does that mean? I don't know, but it's, I would like these two data points, YouTube and Google web search, to tell us something in a preponderance of other things. And it says that it tells you that, you know, web search is up, YouTube views are up. But we also have a conflicting story in that in this quarter, attendance was flat at best in terms of average for Dynamite, and TV ratings were slightly down, I would say. So the YouTube and the Google search here don't help us in telling a preponderance of data points that tell a story here. They conflict with it.
Yeah. Maybe that's, some of the viewers that have gone away, that's how they're kind of getting their AEW fix. They're like, I'm not going to watch it weekly, but I'll watch 10 minutes of videos or something like that. I'm
maybe
always curious
about
that.
There's news stories can affect this. Who knows?
Sure. Yeah. We'll round out with forecasts and things we're looking ahead to, obviously, as we sit here, about 2 weeks ago before the end of the first quarter, some things that we're thinking about top of mind, the attendance woes. We'll talk more about that story the next time out, but how do they turn things around and get more people to come out? What have they learned? What do they change? And, can't just be a new set. It has to be a lot of things that we talked about earlier. Overall, it was a quiet Q1 in terms of big events. They did not have a pay-per-view in January. They did not have a pay-per-view in February. They had the big one in March. So that's interesting because they are going to go on a run here where the next quarter, Q2, they're going to have another new pay-per-view, AEW Dynasty. That's going to be another three pay-per-view quarter. So Q2 is going to be notable them for Dynasty, Double or Nothing, and then Forbidden Door. So that should be good. Will the new signings mean anything in terms of will we start to see any upticks in any of the key numbers? With now Monet and Okada, we'll see when MJF returns, but Ospreay as well, and how they're able to leverage these talents on TV, where they are doing just that, leveraging them. How they work in with the current roster. How can Collision get some sort of bump out of it, and so on? And how's the new hierarchy work? People that were main eventing before, are we going to see them jettisoned to other places? Could that bolster things? So essentially, with this big roster and even more talents coming back with Omega and MJF and talents like that at some point, how's this all play out? How they leverage everything and do something that until the Continental Classic, I feel like Tony Khan had been hesitant to do, which is put a lot of first-time matches on free TV. And you'd see some cases of that, certainly. But I think one of the reasons, at least for me, that the Continental Classic felt so fresh was that a lot of the matches we had never seen before, and without the Classic, you would probably have to wait, like a Swerve Strickland against John Moxley, for example. Then in the past, a year ago, Tony Khan may have said, okay, I want to get a storyline there because that's a big match, and it would just take kind of forever to get to. Where the Continental Classic, you saw a bunch of first-time matches within a short period of time, which I thought was really great. The Sting retirement, will that be a template for future success in terms of retirements? You don't want to become the promotion that does all the retirement tours, but they do have some people like Adam Copeland, who's mentioned this is his last run. Chris Jericho, we'll see about him. There's these guys, I think, that saw that and are going to think to themselves, how do I do the same thing?
Do more people in AEW need to retire?
Exactly.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. We need some more retirements. Paul, the Big Show, Paul White. I'm sure every person that's had a name is thinking, how do I get something similar to that? Not everyone can have that, but I think, one thing I think AEW has done really well, they've done a lot of things really well, but I think one thing that they've done exceptionally well is this respect for the past and also bringing the emotion into it and leaning into it versus then backing away from it. Where WWE, it's very much history is one of those things they lean on when they want to, but they don't lean all the way in. They have the angle right now with The Rock and everything. It's his star power, it's nostalgia. People know him, but they're not really leaning too heavily into the past. It's just, it's him.
Tony Khan is a wrestling fan in the way most of the people listening to this are wrestling fans, I think. In that, as opposed to WWE, which is a sort of isolated WWE universe, unless they purchase your library, then they might, allow your parts of your history to be acknowledged. And that's, I think that fact is maybe why it contributes to the reason why some people, fans, disliked Tony Khan, maybe WWE fans. But yeah, they acknowledge wrestling history, even though, it's not part of their history.
Right. Yep. And I think this thing, I just kind of wonder if that's, if you can't do it all the time because it takes away from the effectiveness, but I wonder, as time goes on, years from now, and people are kind of done with their WWE run, if they're like, they're not going to give me a send off, I wonder if I can have a send off somewhere else and make some money doing it. So just some, the way that they handled his whole run, I think, is an interesting template for something they could do in the future with other guys. You can't do it with everyone, but there's something you can do there to make them special and make it feel special to fans and make a shit ton of money doing it. I think that's a thing that's just kind of stuck in the back of my mind. And as we talked about before, the march towards a new TV deal. Again, we've mentioned that we don't know when the exclusive rights are up, when the deal could happen. There's just a lot of questions and more questions than answers when it comes to that.
So Tony mentioned on the last media call that he's very, very confident that they're going to get a huge, huge increase on all three shows. So that, obviously, that's not putting any numbers to it. It's not putting a factor to it or a dollar amount to it. But he did have a response, I think it was to a question from Dave, about how confident he is that they're going to get a huge, huge TV deal. And from there, he went into talking about how that's going to make AEW sustainable, which I think is code language for profitable for the future, which is absolutely the whole theory of this business model. The whole business plan here is that you can get perhaps a strong TV deal that makes all of this worth it in the end. Is this company profitable right now? Almost certainly not. Will it be profitable if they double their current domestic TV rights deal? Probably. And then from there, this is no longer something that, you know, ShadCon has to fund. It's no longer just an investment, but a business that is actually making money for itself.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very fascinating stuff to watch. And it's going to be a fascinating year. Anything else forecasting wise is caught your eye or interested in seeing how things develop?
So as I'm ranting earlier about, it's the content. It's not all these little stories that people twist themselves into various angles to think about why, for example, attendance is down. But I would, you know, I'm always hesitant to say too much about the content because I don't have a lot to say about it, and I don't think that's my area necessarily. But as we're saying, it's the content that does have an effect on the business, especially in this analysis. So and we have all this new talent coming in, and in terms of those facts and those stories, I would ask this question: Who are like two or three of the biggest stars in AEW right now?
I'd say Kenny Omega, Mercedes Moné. I would say Chris Jericho is
okay.
When it comes to stars, enough. Yeah.
Do you think most listeners would agree and pick the same three?
I think it's personal choice.
There would be a lot of debate about who those people are, I think.
Yeah.
And I think notice you didn't say Samoa Joe.
I didn't.
Who's the current champion? I just think that there's not much of a hierarchy, I guess, in AEW in terms of, like, I don't feel like I know who the champion, for one thing, is not the biggest star. Not to disparage Samoa Joe, who's been a stabilizing force in this title picture that needed a stabilizing force.
Sure.
But that there isn't a clear hierarchy of these are the tippy top people. This is the next level down and so on. And I think that's been an issue for AEW, in fact, for all of its history, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think I don't know if that's something that's going to get fixed anytime soon. I suspect over time, maybe that will become more straightened out because AEW will have more of a history to it. And we're getting away from this time where there's a lot of contract rollovers from WWE that's bringing in, you know, these explosive debuts that are a big deal. And then people sort of float in these non-defined categories for a long time. Anyway, I think AEW would be benefited from a more defined hierarchy of who are the very top five people, who's the next level down, the next level down, the next level down. Mm-hmm. What there is right now people who win matches and people usually lose matches. There's that for sure.
Sure.
But there's not much in between.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was thinking about that. I think about that a lot, about they don't elevate a lot of people to that upper level where it's like, you know, they're the top stars. People just kind of figure it out on their own because People are there and then they disappear. People are there, then they may be off for a couple of weeks, and there's this in out territory feel to it. But you're right, it needs a established upper tier that fans also are like, again, the WWE thing, you can say, here's your main eventers. If you had your biggest event of the year, here's what we want. If you were to say, what are we working toward at All In? We have no idea. But you can easily say, here's probably where we're working to for WrestleMania. A year out, 6 months out, you know, even something, you know, several months out, you can easily say, this is where they're going, because they have an established path there, and they really don't have that in AEW.
Yeah, and just to connect this, ground this down into business, is that if you do that, theoretically, is with the argument that I'm making, is that you can, it's easier to make stars who matter to your TV ratings, who can pop your attendance, who can sell merchandise more strongly, and it's easier to create new stars on top of that, because there's this strict hierarchy. Doesn't have to be strict, but there is a hierarchy that people can travel through, and you can sort of understand, the fans can understand better that people are becoming bigger and bigger stars. They're becoming people that I have to pay attention to, that I have to tune in to see. And something really exciting is happening, because these two people are meeting after this long journey, and I want to buy a ticket. I want to buy a pay-per-view to see that happen. I think those sort of emotionally connecting stories are easier to tell when there is a defined hierarchy of wrestlers.
Right. I'm paying a ticket to be part of a moment, you know.
It's all about the moments.
When people are going to SmackDown, they're this time around. I mean, WWE's been hot as all get out, but like, they're going to see. I want to be there to see what happens when The Rock speaks now, or I want, you know, or a confrontation between, you know, these upper levels, because they know it's part of that moment. You feel that, and you feel like you're like, this is a cool place to be. And
you chant yeet. I want to be there for that moment. Where you chant yeet.
Yeet, exactly. Well, you never know. People may chant WrestleNomics the next time they see you at one of these great shows. And obviously, you can chant WrestleNomics all you want on WrestleNomics' Patreon, which you can go to right now. Patreon, search for WrestleNomics. And $5 a month, I believe, is still the going rate, correct?
It's still, there's a free trial, even if you want to try it out for 7 days for nothing. You can do that.
Exactly.
But it is $5 after that per month.
Yep. And Brandon does a podcast every Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern, almost every Sunday, unless he's preempted by travel. And usually it's either a little bit later in the day, sometimes from an airport, sometimes from a cafe. You never know. A hotel
you
room.
You never know. Hotel room. Yeah. I think the post WrestleMania episode will be not on a Sunday, but yeah, but generally Sunday at 11.
There you go. Yeah. So you can get that, watch that. And if you want a sample, of course, 7 day free trial. He also does still one free episode a month. The other ones are behind the paywall, but also that, and also does, you know, plenty of event recaps in terms of ratings and attendance and all these things. And what is the term used now? Like when you write like Dynamite, here's all the numbers. What are you calling that now? You just made that
a show report.
Show report.
So for every AW and WTV show, there is a show report which has the TV rating in it and all of the breakdowns and analysis of the TV rating, various charts that go with it, and then also a live attendance, live event analysis using WrestleTix data. There's a YouTube chart. Here's the ranked, you know, clips from YouTube of this show and how they all, you know, how it all broke down. And well, we're putting cage match data at the end there too. Here's what the matches were rated as by the people voting on cage match. Here's how they rated this event, this TV show, and comparing that across time with averages throughout the quarter and things like that.
Yep. Now, so you follow them on Brand Thirst on X, WrestleNomics, and what else is there plugged? Did I get everything? Obviously, Pollock and Thurston.
TikTok, you can swipe us up on TikTok, and you can get your TV ratings on TikTok, a lot of them anyway, and Instagram.
All right, good stuff. All right, Brand Thurston, thanks so much for stopping by. We'll have you back shortly, in probably about a month or so, maybe. We'll maybe try to do a little bit earlier, the Q1 review, and yeah, that's good stuff. Brand Thurston, thanks so much.
Thanks, Josh, for having me.
All right. Big thanks to Brandon Thurston, as always, for stopping by. Very busy guy, but glad grab any time I can with him and to do this Investors Call series every 3 months or so. And I promise that the next one will be up earlier. So probably looking at April, maybe a month from now or so. We'll talk about the first 3 months of 2024 when it comes to numbers in AEW. Numbers. That's what wrestling is all about, right? And coming up in the next few days, we're going to talk about anything but numbers, because Jack Encarnacio, JP from the Laps Fan are going to return to this podcast once again. And they are here to promote, as always, as you might expect, because the guys have another live show coming up during WrestleMania weekend. We'll talk all about the first one they had, what's different for this one, if there's going to be any pratfalls, mattresses, if you remember, for people to sleep on, if you remember the last show, and all types of stuff. Always good laughs, so we'll have some fun. That'll come out probably Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. And yeah, it should be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to that. And also some other good conversations ahead. Easy for me to say as we really get 2024 rolling on this here podcast. You know, it's mid-March, spring training's in session. Baseball's about to start. Let's get fired up. Huh? Let's get out of this slumber and get to it. So you have a lot of choice in your podcast today. I greatly appreciate the time you spend with me or any of the fine folks here at WrestlingObserver.com. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.